Wait a minute. That's what I thought. Sort of put myself back in. You know what's not too hard as long as I don't keep sliding.
Okay.
Well, Kenny's going to introduce me.
All right. Okay. Is that adjusted?
Yeah. It's adjusted.
All right. Then what I'll do is.
Starting right at 3:30, or
you started early. Get more time in. Start right on time, so about 3 or 4 minutes, I'll get it started. Which order of books do you
want? Hello, I'm Bill Wright. We met, I think, 15 years ago at Butterfly. Was it about 15 years?
I don't know what you mean by Butterfly.
Whirlwind Butterfly, a Friday night meeting.
Quite possibly.
John Hitchcock had me as our surprise guest.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yes, I was there.
Except I think that meeting, there was a meeting at that little church in the valley.
Trinity Presbyterian.
Yeah, well.
Did you speak again at Great Valley Baptist?
Yeah, the Great Valley Baptist. I remember that.
Well, this was Butterfly on Friday night. I couldn't write. It had to be. I've got 20 years. It had to be about 15 years ago.
Well, that's possible.
We remember going through it.
Oh, I'm so glad you knew that. I'm very glad to be here.
I have a brother in the company. For God's sake, get a tape recording of it. And I said, I think they've made that arrangement. Yeah, well.
Say about this.
You need a pencil?
No.
No. Okay.
That's mother. That's what she looked like at the age when she introduced Bill and Bob.
Okay.
So I thought I'd show that, hold it up.
A bit of a saint putting up with
Well, I wouldn't say that. No. Absolutely not.
I don't know how
she was. You know, remember Kennedy said that happiness was using your powers to the best of your ability at the time. The sense that you were using your powers. I think that she had the sense that she was functioning fully as a human being. And so it was a wonderful experience for her. So you don't have to be a saint to do that. I mean, how many of us would like to have that sense, feeling?
Right. Right.
And occasionally we all do. Hopefully, but she had it for quite some time. So a saint has to really suffer and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, I didn't mean it that way. But.
I know, but you were saying, I know what you meant. I know exactly what you meant, but I'm always arguing about meaning of words. I'm an English teacher.
Do you use Warner's handbook?
No, I haven't used that. Yes, I have, as a matter of fact. Because I was teaching at Great Valley, and they used it, and I thought it was wonderful. I still have a copy.
Do you want me to use one of these?
Yeah, for your announcement, sure.
quick heads up. George has been kind enough to set up videotaping and recording of this entire presentation. So it's being recorded, videotaped, and so if you could minimize distractions for the next hour or so, that would be really appreciated. This recording will be given to the Southeastern Pennsylvania Intergroup Association's Archive Committee and will be featured on the Recovery Radio section of the Malvern Center website. All right? So, with that in mind, I'm blown away, and I've tried to make this happen for a year, and this is Mary Cyberling Hune. This is Henrietta's daughter, and really more my mother than anything else. We met when I was in kindergarten, and her son is still my best friend to this day. And it blew me away. I think it was 1998, I was at her son's wedding, and we were sitting waiting for them after the ceremony and everything was done, waiting for them to come down after they changed. And I said, wow, this is my 8th anniversary. I forgot, I've been so busy all day. She said, that's wonderful, congratulations. That's really a big accomplishment. And then a pause, and you said, tell me that I told you that AA started in my mother's house.
What? What?
And that started a dialogue that blew me away. I now remember as a kid, and what was it, the 60s and 70s, I'd come over before my parents would have Thanksgiving dinner. I'd drop over and see you guys, and your mom would be there.
Mm-hmm.
So sitting in the living room is Henrietta Cyberling, just rocking in a chair.
Yeah.
Just carefully, just just watching all of us crazy people run around going, So what an incredible revelation. And, you know, so we couldn't hide her any longer. I had to make sure that, you know, we got her in here because she lives in Berwyn, for God's sake. So without further ado, I'll get out of your way and, you know, ask you to welcome Mary.
Can you hear me okay? It's okay, huh? I just want to say about meeting Kenny. When my son came home from kindergarten that day, or first grade, I can't remember which, and he said, guess what, Mom? I've got a friend. And he's not the kind of person who had a whole lot of friends, but that friendship has endured all this time. And later on, when I was going through stuff, I found this, they were used to play detective, and I found this little card that said, X something or other, you know, his official card, and then the mission was, get Kenny. So that's their connection. Well, I first of all, I want to say that I regard myself as sort of a historical relic, because the only reason I'm here is because of the just happens that I was the daughter, along with my sister and my brother, of the woman who welcomed Bill W. when he first came to Akron and was in very bad straits psychologically. But I thought I would start out by telling you a little bit about my mother, because I think it's interesting how her background led to this in some way. First of all, she was born in Kentucky, but brought up in Texas, and her father was a judge, and her mother was very religious, and yet a very sort of a woman of the world. She knew how to do things. And she sent my mother to Vassar College. She graduated in 1908. And at that time, all of her friends were just shocked that she would send her daughter to a college, you know. But mother just loved it, and she had all the education and cultural upbringing that you could like. And so when she finally got married, my father had been in World War I, and went to live in Ohio with a huge family. My father's family was very large. My grandfather had founded Goodyear, And then he, after that went, the banks took over Goodyear. Then my grandfather started Cyberling Rubber Company. And so there was this huge family, and my grandmother had expected that mother, who was an only child, would thereby find a large family to have a community with. But it didn't work out that well. And my father was, and she did not, had a lot of problems. So at this particular period in her life, when things began to get pretty rough, and my father eventually moved up into the big house. We called it the big house. Was the huge house my grandparents lived in, and we lived in the gatehouse. And this was, of course, shortly after Roosevelt became president, and things were tough all over. And Bill Wilson, I mean, you know the story, I presume. But anyway, he came to Akron and was in the Mayflower Hotel, and his great plans, as very often great plans do, was falling through. And he went into the room where, and I've been there many times myself, or I had been there, where people were having a lot of fun and drinking and so forth, and he thought, if I don't do something right away, I'll be drinking with them, because he was getting depressed. And that's when he, by chance, he said, went through this long list of names that had been given to him by an Oxford group connection, and he just happened to finally, after he, I think he went through a long list, hit on Reverend Tunks. And Reverend Tunks had been connected with the Oxford group, and he recommended that he see Henrietta Cyberling, and he recommended he see Norman Shepherd, who was an Oxford grouper and knew Mother very well. And so he recommended that. Well, he thought that this would be the important Mrs. Cyberling. So he was afraid to call, but he finally forced himself to do it. And it's a good thing that it wasn't that Mrs. Cyberling, because she probably would have been too busy to see him on a Saturday afternoon. And he came up with the famous statement, introductory statement about himself, which I was really shocked that when they made the movie of AA, they didn't use this line, because it was so wonderful. And he said, "I'm a rum hound from New York, and I need to talk to someone." Well, meanwhile, Mother had become involved with the Oxford group quite some time before this. Harvey Firestone had a son who was a drunk, and he had hoped that if the Oxford group came to Akron, that it would help Harvey's son, Bud, get over his drinking. So Mother, since she had been going through these difficulties, and since she was religiously inclined, I think she read more of the Bible, the New Testament, at this time of her life than she ever had before. She probably heard a lot of it from grandmother, but she started reading because she was trying to seek help all the time, as Bill was too. And so she went to this meeting, and I remember she took my brother, and my brother was very boastful, and he came home and he said, "Guess what? I went to the Oxford group." But anyway, so the Oxford group was so the Oxford group was took on well in Akron, but then it began to go in sort of not a good direction, because they began to Frank Bookman, who started it, wanted to get back to first century Christianity, which was simplicity and, you know, the basic absolutes and all of that sort of thing. And then in order to spread the message, they used to have house parties, and they'd invite a lot of people in a particular area. And in order to have house parties, they had to have people who had big houses where they could have the house parties. So then they began to cultivate people who had big houses and could have the house parties, and then that made them sort of cultivate a more wealthy and established people. And Mother didn't think this was good, and there were several other people who didn't feel at home or comfortable with this, and they started their own little prayer group. And then they did the Oxford group thing. I mean, they shared their worries and concerned and their failings, and they confessed to what they had to get over and all that sort of thing, and gave each other help, and they got guidance for one another. And they all, in this group, of course, was Bob Smith. And Bob Smith was a rectal surgeon, and he was a silent drinker. No one ever saw him drink. He just drank when no one knew about it, but he would come home drunk. And everyone in this group knew that Bob was a drinker, but no one ever said that. No one ever mentioned it. And so my mother thought, well, we're not going to be able to help Bob unless he admits that he has a problem. So she spoke with the group, and she said, the only way we're going to get Bob to admit he has a problem is if we all tell about our own most serious problems that we really don't even want to talk about, but we'll just admit to them and ask for help. So she said they had this one wonderful meeting, and she said, I'd like to know what she said in that meeting. I never found out. But there was a range of choices she could have said. But anyway, she said, I told things about myself that I never thought I would tell anyone. But she said, I said, I really need help with this, and I want you all to pray for me. And everyone did the same. And finally, Bob got up, and he said, what I'm going to say, I don't even want to tell you, but he said, I have to do it, because he said, it might cost me my practice, but I have to admit, I'm a silent drinker. And he said, I don't know why I do it. He said, I don't like the taste, I don't like the effects, and yet I can't stop. And he said, I want you to pray for me. So they said, well, we're glad you told us, and we will pray for you, and we know there will be help coming to you. So anyway, Mother was read the Bible a lot, and she sometimes, in the middle of the night, she would get guidance. And she said that night she was thinking about Bob, and she thought, before that night she had been thinking about Bob, and she thought, well, the best way to stop is to slowly taper off. And that's the sensible thing. I mean, it's irrational thinking. And but she said that night she went to bed, fell asleep, she woke up, and she suddenly got this message as though it were a message from above, which said, Bob must stop drinking cold turkey. And she thought afterwards about that. She said, that doesn't make sense. But she said, nevertheless, that was what the message was. So she told the prayer group that, and Bob said, well, I've tried that, and it just doesn't work. So anyway, it was with this background that Bill came. And I always thought it was so great that he was immediately asked to come, and that Mother immediately thought to herself, manna from heaven, this is the man that can help Bob. And I wrote a little thing about that was supposed to be in the Gatehouse Archives. And I thought, just because I wrote it, and it'll sort of sum up the story in a neat way, which was a Gate Lodge memory of AA. In those early days of what eventually became known as AA, my sister Dorothy and I were in our early teens. Sometimes in the evening or late at night, those pioneering alcoholics who were helping themselves by helping other alcoholics find the road to recovery would bring their recruits to our little kitchen in the Gate Lodge to be sobered up enough to take the next step, probably to a hospital for detoxification. I think that ought to be, in a way, the first step. You know, you have 12 steps. That's really becomes the first step. While they were being plied with cup after cup of strong coffee, we two girls would sit on the steps of the staircase right outside the kitchen and listen to the goings-on in there. Most of the time, the candidates were so drunk that their voices were very loud enough so that we could hear everything they said. Some of the stuff they would blurt out was so outrageously funny or devilishly witty that their unseen audience could hardly keep from laughing. When we had the opportunity of meeting some of those alcoholics after they had started on their road to recovery, their sobriety seemed to have robbed them of the wit and humor we had so enjoyed listening to. But when they were well launched on their new journey, more secure perhaps, they seemed to have become more humorous than ever, as though a kind of inner freedom prompted them to tell jokes about themselves so that we could laugh along with them. No wonder they celebrate that first day of real sobriety as their birthday. That's the day when they stepped out of darkness into real life as a new person. Way back in the 30s, we saw it happening and heard it happening. So that was my initial experience of AA. And I've always thought of this as, you know, when Mother called up Bob Smith and wanted him to come over that night, he couldn't do it because he was out of it, you know. It was the day, night before Mother's Day, he had gotten drunk, he brought his wife a plant and then passed out. So they agreed that they would come the next day, and evidently he said to Mother, I'll come, but no longer than 15 minutes, because he was afraid that he would not be able to stand it, you know. But they came at 5 o'clock and they stayed till after 11. And in our little house, and we had a very small kind of a library area where they sat and talked things over. And after that, they were the best friends. And then he went to hospital for detoxification. Now, after this, I understand from reading this wonderful book. Where is it? I think, yeah. No, there was another book called Kenny.
What?
There was another book called Dr. Bob.
It's in your lap.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's so typical. Anyway, this book by Bob and about Bob and afterwards, as if any of you have read this book, have you? How he went off the wagon several times, even after he had been through this experience, and then he went to an American Medical Association meeting, and he got very drunk, and then he got that was his final day of ever getting a drunk, and after that he was definitely an AA. So, in this book it says. Oh, and there was that frightening episode where he had to perform an operation, and they had to give him a beer or some sort of things he had to drink to make sure that he could get through the operation and not endanger the patient. Well, he went through the operation, and it was a success, but that was the last time he ever had a drink. And so they call that, I mean, we always thought of the day that Bob and Bill met at our house as being the first day of AA, but they consider this was the first day, which was, it is generally agreed that Alcoholics Anonymous began there in Akron on that date, June 10th, 1935. So there are sort of two beginnings, you know, there's the introduction and then there's the beginning. So, anyway, Mother was quite involved with AA for some time until she eventually took an apartment in New York, and then there were enough meet groups so that each one of them could handle the alcoholics that came. And Mother was, I think, a wonderful influence on Bill because of the fact that Bill sometimes, as he had mentions it in his book, Pass It On. This, have you all read Pass It On? It's a terrific book, isn't it? And he mentioned the fact that from the time that he was a little boy, he always wanted to achieve something and be the first one to do it, you know? And that's a wonderful spirit, I think. But there are times when you should have that spirit and at times when it's sort of counterproductive. And one of the times that it would have been counterproductive was when the book AA was written. And he would consult with Mother, and he was very proud of the book and so forth. And he said, I think I should, you know, and he was going to sign it Bill Wilson. And mother said, uh-oh, no, 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 no. She said, it's got to be anonymous. Because she had seen how, you know, egos and all that sort of thing had been helped to put a slow down the benefits of the Oxford group. And then, and so he agreed. He said, well, that's a good idea. And so that was one accomplishment that was very important. And then later on, when Bill was thinking about how to finance the growth of this, and he thought we could get the Rockefeller Foundation or the Ford Foundation or whatever to, you know, sponsor it and donate money and so forth. And Mother had seen how this cult of money, what it had done to the Oxford group, and she said, no, no, you mustn't get, money will ruin everything. She said, it just has to come from the people. So that was another very good principle that she introduced. And so, as you can see, that the mother's connection with Bill was a very fruitful one and helpful. And I think a lot of it was from what she had learned in going through the difficulties that she went through and seeking help. And Bill himself was always seeking help. I suppose you read that he had written a letter to Jung, to Carl Jung. And I was really so amazed when I read his book how close to suicide he was. You know, how he thought he might be losing his mind. He just didn't know how to cope. And then he had that terrific experience of a kind of a revelation in which he suddenly gained his freedom from alcoholism, which, you know, the workings of the human brain and spirit are something very mysterious and marvelous. So other people haven't had that. I mean, they've had to go through trial and error until finally they reach the point where they can stick with it, and that's really wonderful too. But when I was got my granddaughter to type this for me, because I had ruined my first copy that I tried to copy on my copying machine. So she typed it over because she's a better typist than I. And so when I had to read it to her, because I had had to copy it all out by hand, and I had to read her what my handwriting was. So when I came to that last paragraph, I said, no wonder they celebrate that first day of real sobriety as their birthday. That's the day when they stepped out of darkness into real life as a new person. And I said, you know, I said, it practically brings tears to my eyes to think of it. And she said, yeah, Grandma. She said, I can hear it. I can hear that in your voice. And it's true. Because when I come here and when I look out at this huge number of people here, it's just kind of an incredible thing, isn't it? Really, when you come to think of it. Yeah, right. So I don't know what else to say. I did bring some interesting books, though. First of all, I did want to say that this picture of Mother that's in this, well, I went to the Gatehouse lately, and not long ago, to see my brother, and this was a picture of Mother they have on a postcard that's when she was very young. You know, I think of that as her sort of her hoity-toity years. And this is, of course, the beautiful estate on which we grew up. And this is a picture of what Mother looked like when she was going through all of this. That's the mother that was helpful to Bill Wilson and everything. And so I just thought I'd say that. And then I wanted also to show you when Mother was trying to find help, spiritual guidance, and sustenance, one of her favorite books, I don't know if you've ever heard of this, called The Soul's Sincere Desire. That has one, and so I was thought, well, you know, she gave us all a copy, and I read in it, but it didn't register too much. But in thinking about AA and what all of us need, AA or not, I was rereading some of it, and it really is an absolutely marvelous book. And I could see, and she, you know, marked certain passages, and I could see why it was such a terrific help to her. So I would just mention this in case you're, any of you are interested. It's one of the, just one passage I thought I'd read, which I thought was really good. It says, up to now, he's talking about Jesus. And he says, up to now, the world in general and his professed followers in especial have failed as a whole to experience the power which he said he was going to leave with us. The question that is left unanswered is, what is the power which Jesus promised he was going to leave us, and where shall we find it? And then he goes on and says, I have come to the conclusion that the greatest of all the lost arts, lost for these 20 centuries, is the great art of living as Jesus practiced it, living in such a way that trouble fell like scales from the eyes of all those about him who were in need. And then he goes on and talks about how to find that way of living. And one of the interesting things he says is that Jesus always spoke in parables. You know, he'd always give an example of something. And so I thought, you know, one of the things that helped AA's start was the fact that they thought of themselves as being in a parable. I mean, the way they lived and the way they conducted their lives was going to teach other people in the same way. So in a way, you're all parables. And I'm a parable. And then this is another book that I don't know whether any of you have read this book, For Sinners Only. Well, no wonder that you haven't read it, because, I mean, why would any of you pick up a book that had such a title? But anyway, this is the book that Frank Bookman wrote. And he gave it, no, he didn't. A.J. Russell wrote it about Frank Bookman. And Frank Bookman gave it away at his meetings. And this is the one he gave to Mother. And this also is a very interesting book if you're at all interested in exploring the history of it. And Frank Bookman, I think he had a terrific idea. One idea that wasn't so terrific was he thought he could change Hitler. And I think that would have been a little bit difficult. And then as an indication of the wonderful way that Bill Wilson really had a terrific intellect. And as you know, he was an inventor in his youth. He was always inventing things. He made a boomerang. That was his first thing he talked about. And he always wanted to, you know, really succeed in some astonishing way. And he wrote a letter to Carl Jung, which you may have read. And he gave Mother a copy of a wonderful book by Carl Jung called Modern Man in Search of a Soul. And it was inscribed to her. And darned if I can ever find that book. I read it. Mother, I don't think, ever bothered to read it. But it was a great book, and if you're ever interested. But another book he gave her, which I know she didn't read, but I read. And this was called The Perennial Philosophy by Aldous Huxley. And it's, and here it says, Henrietta Dear, may the next 12 months bring you all that is good. Affectionately, Bill. And this was in Christmas of 1940. So anyway, the basic idea about this book is it goes into all the different great religions of the world and compares them and comes up with the basic idea that basically they all, the great religions all say the same thing. So I guess that's why she felt she didn't really need to read it. So anyway, I just think it's great to be here, and I love seeing you.
Read the second thing you wrote.
Oh yeah, this is. If any of you are interested in sort of the what Bill was like, this was another thing I wrote for the Gate Lodge Archives. On that momentous occasion, when Bill W. came to the Gate Lodge for the first time, my sister and I watched from behind the portieres that separated the small dining room from the living room. These portieres made the dining room into an ideal vantage point from which we could observe grown-ups before we were formally introduced. And believe me, did we make use of that. I don't think we paid much attention to what Bill and our mother talked about, but we noticed that he was unusually tall and lanky, and he spoke with a kind of drawl. In my memory, he sounds like Jimmy Stewart. As he sat on the couch, he stretched out his long legs and rested the heel of one foot atop the toe of the other foot. And he would move each foot back and forth at an angle to the other foot as he talked. He did this all the time. Finally, we came out from behind the portieres and were introduced to Mr. W. After he left, my mother asked us what we thought about him. And to this day, I remember my sister's comment, "He has the longest feet of any man I've ever seen." So anyway, and here's a picture. I must say, admit that I got this on Google, the Gate Lodge. But it's a very nice picture that you could get yourself. And of course, I look at it and it brings back many memories. And so I can't think of anything else to say. But I might say, if you have any questions or anything, I'd be very happy to try to answer them. You know, I wish I did know, but I don't know. But I can sort of imagine it, because we had met Bob, of course, before, and he was a very impressive man. He had kind of a long face and a very deep voice, and he was quite taciturn. And so I imagine, since he had been reluctant to come, he may have just simply shaken hands and said, "Glad to meet you." You know, it was probably very formal. And then when they went on and found out what Bill's mission was and spent all those hours in that little room, I wish I had known what they said there, but you can sort of imagine it yourself.
Thank you.
My name is Bill, I'm an alcoholic. Now, I hope this doesn't make you feel uncomfortable. It was reported that one of the cyberbullying kids said that Bill was smarmy. Have you ever heard that?
Never. Never.
Okay, I'll put that to bed.
Yeah. No, I was really kind of felt sorry. You know, at one point, Bill said when he met that young woman who he first fell in love with and she died, and he went into a terrible depression, and he said that he felt that he was really homely. I didn't think of him as homely at all. You know, he looked like a sort of a rugged, type of person, you know. I there are such terrific pictures in that book, Pass It On, so why you would say he was smarmy is beyond me. Well, not one of us, none of us said that. In the first place, I've never used that word in my life, so. Well, no, he didn't. But I'll tell you one thing he did, which is sort of not unusual for certain men of a great build, you know, who were strong and heavy. He wasn't fat or anything, but he was a big guy. Well, we had these little, mother had this house decorated in kind of early, late 18th century. They had these chairs called Hitchcock furniture, maybe you're familiar with it, and they're sort of thin wood with a straw, thick woven straw seat, and they're very delicate, and they have a nice painting on the back. And mother had one that was next to the piano, and Bill would occasionally, as people do, I mean, you know, the way people use furniture, my grandchildren have used it, for instance. They don't respect this kind of furniture. And so he would occasionally start to lean back, and she would say, "Bill, don't lean back in that chair, it's too delicate." So in the heat of discussion, he leaned back in it, and the whole thing fell apart. I think he had met him once, but he didn't really know him. He had met him, that's all.
And then, first of all, I just want to thank you and your family for all the good that you've done in that part of Ohio, all the magnificent charity works, and the fact that you turned the house over to the people is just wonderful.
Yes, well, that was wonderful, and that was my family, my cousins and my uncles who did that. And but my grandfather did some terrific things too. I mean, one reason he lost control of Goodyear was because he used a lot of his stock and my grandmother's stock to pay for homes for the employees and have a playground for their children and everything. And he always had was always thinking of the people as a whole. So I thought that was really great. I would like to say one more thing about Bill. You know, Bill keeps coming into my mind. Strangely enough. One of the things I liked about Bill was his love of music. You know, he did learn the violin, and at one point we went up and visited Bill and Lois. I think their home had a house in Connecticut. And I remember seeing Bill sit down with his, at this time he was playing the cello, which was to me much more appropriate because he was very tall and this was a great instrument for him. And he was playing the beginning of Dvorak's cello concerto. And it was really nice. And I thought, gee, he's really talented, you know. I didn't hear him play the whole thing, but I thought he was a very talented man musically. So that was nice to know. An endearing thing. There's someone in there that has a question. Oh, there's someone over there. Okay, you next in there.
I have a question. And I hope that this is not an insulting or inappropriate, but it's something about which I am curious. You're sharing so much about people in your life who have had an impact on your life. But one of the things I found, I wasn't sure of when I came over here today, is if you ever became one of us.
No, I never did. And you know, they're finding out more and more about addiction and what causes it. And they're finding out more and more that people do inherit a tendency to become an addict of any kind. People who, and it's a matter of I don't know what your DNA or what it is, but some people have more of a capacity for becoming addicted than others. And the reason I know I'm not addictive, is that at one point in my life, I tried to become a cigarette smoker. because it was when I was in my late teens, and there was someone in our neighborhood was getting married, and these people, friends of theirs, came from Iowa, and everyone was smoking, and it looked so cool. We didn't use the word then. I forget what word we used then, but anyway. So I thought, you know, I'm going to be, you know, really cool too. And I started to do everything I saw cigarette smokers do. And of course, there were lots of parties that were going on. But I would have one right after breakfast. And then I would have one in the middle of the day. And then there'd probably be a party in the afternoon. I would smoke then and so forth. Well, Mother was very clever. She did study, one of the things she studied at Vassar, she sort of did more about music because she was a wonderful pianist, but she also studied child care or whatever, something, child care, child psychology or something like that. And she really benefited from that because I could tell that she was using some of the... But anyway, she thought smoking was terrible, but she never said, don't smoke, or I forbid you to smoke, or told me you're a dirty, rotten person for smoking. But just before I would fall asleep at night, she would come in and whisper in my ear, you know, she said, you know, Mary, smoking is not becoming to you. And it's not healthy, but I think using the word not becoming was much more effective to a teenager. And she said, I don't think you should go on doing this, but it's up to you. And then she left. Well, of course, this is one of the most sensitive periods of your day. When you're falling asleep, it insinuates itself into your conscience. And from then on, even though I did occasionally, when I was at college, smoke with after-dinner coffee, you know, there are times when I, probably even now, I could enjoy a cigarette. But I don't bother, of course, especially since they probably caused my husband to die later in life. But nevertheless, every time I did smoke, I feel a deep sense of guilt. So that's it. I mean, I tried to become an addict, and I couldn't.
Well, thank you for being so forthcoming. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
There was someone in there who wanted to ask a question.
Hi, I'm Jackie. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Jackie. Do you have any recollections of either Lois or Ann?
Of what?
Lois Wilson or Ann Smith?
I don't. Ann Smith, of course, I remember very well. Yes, she came over, and the way they described her smoking was, we noticed it as kids, you know, I mean, as teenagers. Because she was constantly smoking, but she would just smoke the beginning and then put it out in an ashtray, so that when she left our house, there would always be these long cigarette stubs. I mean, a person on the sidewalks who wanted to get old cigarettes to smoke, he could have benefited from her. But she was a very pleasant, nice person. I didn't get to know her too well, but every time I saw her, I gravitated toward her. There's a hand in there. You know, that movie to me was a big disappointment. They had some of the events correctly, but I didn't think James Wood was at all, as I remember, Bill Wilson. I mean, you've seen his pictures in this book, the way he was tall and lanky, had that long face, and he, of course, how do they know what he sounded like? And they didn't, I thought Bob was not very memorable. And the way they just had Anne and my mother just sort of background figures, sort of in the background, you never had any feeling that they had anything to do with it. So I didn't really like that movie. And they didn't use that wonderful line, I'm a rum hound from New York. I mean, you know.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing with us and coming in and taking time to
Does the name Ed Andy ring a bell with you at all?
Okay.
Then I won't ask anybody.
Would you say that name again?
Ed Andy.
Ed Andy?
Yeah.
No, it doesn't. No, he had no, because I at that time I didn't live here. I don't think I, because I was living, I was teaching in Maryland and living in New York sometimes, and you know. And he didn't pay too much attention to us. Let's face it. I don't think she was, I think she was maybe 16. Well, she was very smart, you know. I've seen lots of her, I inherited lots of her books and used the same books when I was at Vassar. And I could see how she underlined things and made little notes and everything like that, so. But she wasn't the, addict that I am. That's one thing I am addicted to is books.
Anyone else?
Oh, Lois. Yes, I thought, I didn't get to know Lois very well, but I thought she was very attractive, very womanly, with a sort of a sweet face. And I thought the way she stuck with Bill and went through all that she went through with him is just wonderful. I mean, you know, if anyone could be called a saint, I would say, I don't like to use the word, but if you have to use it, I'd say it to give it to Lois, because she really, her loyalty and her tolerance and her understanding and her suffering and everything that she went through with him was just wonderful. And she saw what was good in Bill and encouraged it. Ditto for Ann.
Thank you very much for coming. I really appreciate it. And my name is Bob L., by the way. And I've been to Cyberlean State several times.
Oh.
Also, the same weekend, we went to Vermont, to Dorset, where Bill grew up. And I always find it funny that in one of Bill's stories, as he's talking about his grandfathers, and he's talking about how his one grandfather was complaining about the church, and there's people going to church in their Sunday best. What you don't realize is Bill Wilson's one grandparent lived here, and the other grandparent lived over here, and there was a church right in between them. And they would sit on the porch and complain about the people going to church in their Sunday best. And the thing of it is also what you have mentioned several times is about books. It's amazing how many books Bill Wilson had, and Dr. Bob, and how they read and everything. And as I was thinking about that, I was thinking, oh yeah, they didn't have the internet, and they didn't have all the television, all these things to distract you, so people mostly read back then.
Yeah.
It was so important, and I just once again would like to thank you very much for coming. I appreciate you.
Well, you know, Bill was always, all of his life, I think, seeking, going out of his way, not only for spiritual insight, but he wanted to know, he would contact doctors, you know, physically, what is making us physically addicted to this, and he'd go to Canada to visit some doctor who had a theory about it, and they talked something about B vitamins, and he would talk to my mother about it, and mother would say, well, you know, you may as well get as much knowledge as you can, but she said you still have to stick to the fact that you are an alcoholic and can't drink. So no matter how much knowledge you get, that's the most important thing, you know. You know, I just want to say one other thing about Bill. I'm still thinking about him. Things that he said that remain in my mind. I remember at one point he said to my mother, this was in the early days, and mother said, and Bill said, I have a vision of huge masses of people being helped by this, this method. And he said, I just have this vision. And mother was afraid that he was getting a little bit megalomaniac about it. And so she'd say, well, it's very nice to have a vision, and, you know, that's good. But he said, meanwhile, you've just got to stick to the immediate what's in front of you now and what the reality is. But I think Bill did have a vision, you know, because he knew, well, we know he did. I mean, you know, when he had that sort of revelation in the hospital. And he knew of all the people that needed help, and he knew that this was a way that they could be helped. So why wouldn't he have had a vision? I mean, it stands to reason, you know, that this should happen.
Hi, Mary. Thank you. I'm Tim. Mary, did you ever have a sense as a young girl or when the book came out or the Saturday Evening Post article came out, did you have a sense that this thing was really big or was going to get, you know, a lot of attention? Or now, are you surprised at how big Alcoholics Anonymous and the Fellowship is?
Well, as I said when I started out, I am surprised now. I mean, I'm not in a state of constant surprise, but when I look at this group here, I mean, this is just a small sample of what has developed. But at that time, strangely enough, you know how young people are. This was an adult thing. The adults were doing this. I didn't need any help. There weren't any alcoholics in my family. And this was something that mother was doing, and it was great, and she was throwing herself into it, and I was very happy about that because it meant a lot to her. She felt as though her life had a great deal more meaning because of what she was doing and how she was helping people. And so I was just kind of, that's why I say I'm a relic of history. I was just kind of tagging along, and we'd go to the Founders Day banquet in New York, and that was always exciting. I remember we went to the Founders Day banquet in one time we went to, and this was during the war, and this was celebrating Bill Wilson's first day of sobriety. That was considered Founders Day then. And that was delightful. It was the same feeling I had when I was sitting on the staircase or afterwards, because all these AAs, quite a few of them, would get up and tell these fascinating stories about where they used to hide their bottles when they, and so forth, all these different things that often came out in that Grapevine magazine. Do they still have Grapevine? And the interesting thing was that I remember so well at this particular day that there was, in the corner of this large banquet room, were the reporters, the journalists. And over in that corner, there was a lot of sort of smoke hanging around there, but none of the alcoholics smoked. And I've heard many an alcoholic say that it was harder for them to quit smoking than it was to quit drinking. And I can certainly agree with that. I'm so glad I didn't succeed because my husband was a smoker, and he tried so many times and eventually got cancer of the larynx, which didn't kill him, but it sapped his vitality, and I mean, he had to have it taken out. And so I feel it was cigarettes really that basically led to his demise. So
Mary, I'm sure I speak for everyone when I tell you how blessed we are to have you in our presence today. This is the second time we've met. It was some 16 years ago. Oh, by the way, believe it or not, my name is Bill W. You spoke at our butterfly meeting over in Berwyn about 16 years ago when you were the surprise guest. And John H., the venerable and beautiful John H., had you there as our surprise guest. So you're not a stranger to me. I do recall in 1998, John and I getting on a bus in North Philadelphia, heading for Akron for Founders Day. And what a marvelous 6.5 hour meeting we had on that bus with the brothers and sisters. It was just something
great.
And then when we got there, John rented a car, and he just simply wanted to show us all the high spots. And I do recall, like it was this afternoon, in the parking lot of the gatehouse. And we just sat there. And finally we took off, and there was a fellow in the car with us, some of the people from on the, off the bus, named Kilroy. And John said, well, we've got to get over to the hospital, and then we've got to get over to Ardmore Avenue for the Smith's home, and then to the cemetery. Kilroy says, well, let's don't go yet, man. That is the gatehouse. And in fact, we sat there for a few more minutes in reference to your former home. But again, thank you so very much for blessing us today.
You know, while I was looking through old stuff, and I did live in a big house, and now I've moved to a small house in Berwyn, and I still haven't unpacked all the boxes. And I was looking for some sewing stuff, and I came across this old this sampler that Mother had given me to sew on when I was sick once. She said to occupy me, and I only got so far with it, and then I guess I wasn't sick enough after that. So I never finished it, but I always had it in my mind because I loved it, and I wish I could find a one that I could do. But the verse I remember so well, and I associate it with the Gate Lodge because the verse was, dear little house, dear shabby street, dear books and beds and food to eat, how feeble words are to express the facets of thy tenderness. And I always think of that. I always think of that when I think of the Gate Lodge, because you know, when you're living a thing, you really can't appreciate what you're living through. I mean, it's impossible. It's only when you look back that then you can see it in perspective and really savor its meaning. And that's the way I feel about the gatehouse.
Has anyone had their hand up for a long time and we missed it?
Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. My name is Tony Bean. I'm an alcoholic. You mentioned a lot of dialogue with your mom and Bill W. When did you leave Gate House, or when did she leave the Gate Lodge and go to New York?
Well, I think we, while we were in college, I graduated in 41, she and my sister in 43, she stayed in the Gate Lodge. But then, of course, the war came, and then my brother also graduated in 41 from Harvard, and of course, he then went into the armed forces, and so she wanted to be in New York, because we were all on the East Coast, or my brother was farther on the East Coast, on another East Coast. But so she then got an apartment in New York, but we always went home to Akron in the summer. I mean, and since I was teaching and could go, I would go there in the summer to be with her.
Did she continue to have a lot of dialogue with the Smiths, Dr. Bob?
She did. I mean, you know, because they were friends, and she saw the Smiths as long as they were alive when she was there in the summer. But, you know, the dates are all kind of confused in my mind, especially when the war kind of took over your main consciousness.
Yes, thank you.
Yes?
Pat. Hi, Pat. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Pat.
Well, a mother was remarkable woman. She was very talented musically. I mean, her piano, if she were doing it today, she could have become, I suppose, a concert pianist. But we had the benefit of going at night and hearing her beautiful play Chopin on the piano, and I mean, it's just strong memory of her marvelous piano playing. But she was also a very, I guess the word is a savvy person. She knew how to work things, you know. She would know, she knew how to accomplish objectives. Like, for instance, when I was in high school, well, here's an example of the sort of thing she would do. I mean, we were living in the gatehouse, and my father didn't have a job, and yet I was just, we were in public school, and at that time the Akron public schools were among the worst in the country, the Ohio public schools, I should say, and I was just not learning anything. I was in the second grade, and all I learned to do was read. I never learned how to add and subtract because I didn't find it interesting, and my brother in the third grade was sort of a cut-up, and so mother just simply heard about this wonderful new school, a private school that was just being started, and it was what they called progressive school, and so she just took us out of King School, enrolled us at the private school, and said, send the bill to F.A. Cyberling, and that's what they did. There was no argument about it. And we went to that school until the Depression really set in. And then my grandfather thought it was really too much of an expense, and so we went back to public schools for a short time. But eventually we got back to that school. Except my brother, who went to Stanton Military Academy because he was just going down the drain in the public high school. I mean, it was just hopeless. So a friend of theirs had wonderful experience sending their son to Stanton Military Academy, and it just was wonderful. He just loved it. He got all kinds of awards, and it just saved him. And, you know, the kind of person that John was, I mean, he's a wonderful person, too. He was the congressman for that area, and he remembers so well. He said when they took him to the station on his way to Stanton Military Academy, he thought to himself, and they left him all alone there, he thought, well, this is it. I either make something of myself now or my life is going to be a mess from now on. And so he was determined. So we all have our moments. Well, I'll tell you, my mother didn't move out so much because my father was in World War I, they were married in, I believe, shortly before we went into that war, and they didn't have a house. So my mother lived at the Stan Hewitt mansion while he was gone. And then after when he came back, they wanted, they went to move to another house in, someplace near Pittsburgh. And mother didn't like it at all. And it just didn't seem very promising. So then they went back, and mother said, I would rather live in the Gate Lodge than in that house, that Pittsburgh place. So that's what they did. So they moved there. And the Gate Lodge had been built for the Gardner's family. And so it was not as well built as it would have been if they had known they were building it for their son and grandchildren and so forth. But so it had a lot of drawbacks to it, but it was okay, you know.
Everybody, thank you so much for participating. I'm sure Mary will spend a few minutes afterwards. I will ask that everybody stack the chairs up accordingly on, I guess, this room, right? And we're going to close the wall eventually, but geez, I guess we don't have a nice way of closing.
I would like to close by just thanking you all for being here and for showing me the kind of appreciation which I don't think I deserve, but I appreciate. And I just want to wish you all the happiness that you can find in this life and success in your endeavors, and congratulations for all that you've become.
My book,
I'd be glad to do that.